So welcome back, everyone, to this evening's session where John and I would like jointly to offer some reflections on compassion, this cultivation, this exploration that we have begun this afternoon. And as usual, we haven't discussed this ahead of time. So who is starting, John?
Since I spoke this afternoon, I think you ought to start off.
Absolutely. I think I'd like to start with a little bit of a personal story. Oddly enough, John and I both began practicing in the same year at the same place, in the Himalayan foothills in McLeod Ganj, which was the home of the Dalai Lama. And I was somewhat taken aback when I arrived in McLeod Ganj into this community of Tibetan refugees, many of whom had not long escaped from Tibet. Being a refugee in India is not the easiest place to be a refugee. And these people had actually lost so much. Again, the story of a life written by conditions outside of their control. These people had actually lost so much, been through so much difficulty, so much heartache. And yet when I arrived there, I was so startled by several things. One was the degree of their joyfulness. Another was the degree of their generosity. And another was the degree of their compassion. I found myself wondering how people could go through so much and come out to where they were with somehow their hearts unbroken, their hearts intact. And seeing this, you know, embodied in so many people, you know, made me understand, you know, certainly as a somewhat naive 17-year-old, that a privileged 17-year-old, that these people clearly knew something that I didn't. They knew something that I didn't. That they had somehow been able to make that choice of leaning towards generosity, joyfulness, compassion, rather than leaning towards resentment and hatred and despair. So this was a kind of very primary inspiration for me. It was the primary inspiration for me in beginning to practice. Many decades later, I listened to the story of a Tibetan monk who had been imprisoned at that time and was imprisoned for many years. And again, went through extraordinary affliction and deprivation. And the Dalai Lama asked this monk, he said to him, "What was your time of greatest danger?" And he said, "My time of greatest danger was when I was in danger of losing compassion for my jailers." And again, this to me was really something very profound, very moving. And I considered about how very different this way of seeing was than it often is in our culture. You know, we don't find it so difficult to find compassion for, you know, a sick puppy or a weeping child or, you know, an elderly person struggling. But, you know, it's well known in many Western countries that in hospitals, yes, if you're in hospital because you've been in a car accident or you've suddenly been struck with an unexpected illness, you will meet a lot of compassion, but you may meet less if you're in hospital because of obesity or addiction. You may meet less. So what does compassion look like that doesn't kind of measure suffering? That doesn't have any blame? That isn't selective? And I find this a deeply important question. When we speak about compassion, of course, we cannot speak about compassion without actually speaking about pain, about suffering, about distress. This word in Pali of dukkha. It's often translated as suffering, but it's somewhat something of an inadequate translation. The way that I think of dukkha more recently is as vulnerability, our shared vulnerability. You know, as human beings, we're vulnerable to injury, to pain, to illness, to dying. None of us has an exemption. You know, as human beings, we're vulnerable to the winds of change and impermanence. And we've surely learned that lesson recently. The many things we can lose, the things we can be separated from, that all things, I mean, sometimes we welcome impermanence and sometimes we really don't welcome it. But none of us are exempt. And nothing that we see or touch or hear or taste or love or hate, all of it is imprinted with this process of changing. As human beings, we're vulnerable to living in a world of unstable conditions. We all stand on shifting sands, you know, where our worlds could crumble and change in a moment. You know, a few days ago, my 91-year-old mother fell, and you know, she fractured her disc in her back, and they took her into hospital, sent her home 6 days later. Today she's back in hospital and apparently she's dying. You know, how did that happen? As human beings, I think, especially in the worlds that we grow up in, you know, we're very vulnerable to being a prisoner of kind of self-image, ideas of perfection, ideas of not being good enough, not being worthy enough, not being lovable enough. And again, I think so much of the Buddha's teaching was an invitation to turn towards these vulnerabilities, to look life in the eye and to say, I know you, I know you. And the Buddha said, you know, I teach just one thing, that there is dukkha and there's an end to dukkha. And he certainly wasn't talking about the ending of aging or the ending of dying or the ending of impermanence or, you know, the ending of the instability of conditions. He says there is truly a freedom from the dukkha of all of the arguments that we have with vulnerability. That this shouldn't be happening. That somehow life is unfair. You know, why is this happening to me? Whose fault is it? I know the story of a woman who'd been living with a chronic illness, very painful chronic illness, for some years. And she said, the moment I could stop asking the question of why is this happening to me, the healing could begin. And the healing, of course, didn't mean the ending of the chronic illness. The healing was a returning to a sense of ground, a sense of freedom inwardly, of not being governed by conditions, no matter how difficult and how painful they are. The Buddha said, you know, dukkha can be responded to with compassion. With compassion. This is what dukkha asks for. no matter where or no matter how it arises. But compassion, I think, can also only begin when we put down our arguments with dukkha. You know, that all of the arguments we have that say, you know, this is not fair, it's somebody's fault, it shouldn't be happening to me. Compassion does not mean inertia. You know, I think compassion has two aspects to it. One is, as John touched upon today, you know, the responsiveness to pain. But the other aspect of compassion is the commitment to ending the sources of pain. The sources of the pain in this world that are born of greed and hatred and delusion. The real commitment to bringing about the end of those sources. I'll hand over to you, John, for the moment.
Thanks, Christina. As you heard Christina just saying, I mean, the main dimension of compassion is a response to dukkha. So it really entails a good understanding of what that dukkha is that we're immersed in. And in a sense, the dukkha, and I'm not going to go into this in detail because it's not really the place to do it, but the dukkha that we're immersed in is really the dukkha of what we construct around the happenings of the world. This is not to say, and as Christina rightly said, you know, that we're going to get rid of birth, age, death, suffering in its general sense, of the pain that we get through injury, the pain that we get through mental trauma, or any of these things. This is not going to happen. But what we're particularly looking at, and this is the ending of dukkha that the Buddha is speaking of, is the ending of the contraction of the constructions that we place around the events of life. A very simple word, and we've used it again and again, both of us have used this again and again, this very simple way is our reactive patterns that we bring to experience as things arise in, you know, in day-to-day life, in the yearly unfolding of events, that we react, and we react in particular ways that actually turn us inward in terms of our own self concerns. I think Christina touched on this at some point. I can't remember exactly in one which particular talk she talked about this, but you know, that pain that we experience actually is very good at constructing a self. Yeah, it's very good at constructing something we feel very strongly. Hence the question that, you know, Christina posed, the why me type questions that we get. Why me? Because it's happening to me. This is somehow, it's personal. You know, it gets very, very personal. These events are actually occurring to me. This sickness, this distress, this suffering is happening to me in this very personal sense. The other way, of course, is through desire, the hunger that we place on the world to satisfy our desires. And that's the other way that we very intrinsically construct a self. And I don't know if you realize this, but of course that self is a very fragile thing in itself. Yeah, it takes a lot of effort for us to keep that self together, yeah, in many ways. Referring back to, in a sense, where I started this afternoon when I introduced this, you know, one of the quotes, that quotation I gave from Nyanaponika. Nyanaponika says, of course, you know, compassion is what takes away from the heart the inert weight, the paralyzing heaviness. It gives wings to those who cling to the lowlands of the self. Yeah, it's a very striking image. Yeah, the more that we cling to our sense of self, the more weighted we are. Yeah, the more heavy things become, the more self-concerned we become. this movement away from that into a feeling of, you know, the vulnerability that Christina's spoken about. I spoke about it as fragility and vulnerability this afternoon. The movement we make towards that as being our shared lot with others, all creatures, all living, moving creatures, human beings down to the smallest creature, is trying some way to stay in existence, yeah, in the best possible ways that it can. In speaking about human existence, that's where our patterns come from. So there's no blame and shame in these patterns that we have. They are patterns to try to keep us alive, to keep us in existence. But of course, they don't do the job that well a lot of the time. They actually construct narratives. They construct stories around ourselves. They reify our sense of self and cut us off from others, and they cut us off from our shared humanity in doing this. Yes, like Christina, I was struck by the immense compassion of those that I wound up with, in when I was very young, at the same age, sort of 17, in India, and the way they didn't seem weighted by that hatred. They didn't seem weighted and heavy with all the aversion. I mean, distressing, awful things had happened to these people. Yeah, and I don't want to overemphasize it, but, you know, like all refugee communities, they had really suffered in coming out of Tibet into India, into circumstances which really didn't suit them. Yet they were still able to show compassion to each other's and care, and the generosity was quite striking at that. And I think that was a product of that compassionate attitude as well. The compassionate attitude is one of opening, you know. Again, just thinking about the quote, you know, a heart as wide as the world is what Nayana Ponika says. This is what it gives you. Not a closed, constricted, hardened heart, but one that is in touch and sensitized and responsive to the pain that we see around us, which includes our own pain, it includes our own distress. But this is our shared inheritance, and that's where we start. This is the empathy, you know. Okay, it's a word of very recent coinage, as I said to you this afternoon, you know? Yet the empathy is in that being able to feel into the shoes of others, because we have, in a sense, inhabited those shoes in different ways. You know, that's our shared experience, and this is the experience of life, and it happens to every living creature. Yeah. And so it's not restricted. It's not hierarchized into, you know, I'm going to treat this sentient creature with any greater respect or any less respect, because we treat all with respect and have a responsibility for those. And I shall say more about that later. I'll pass it back to Christina. Christina.
As with metta, we have all had encounters with compassion in our lives. And they've been very meaningful moments when we're distressed to be held by the compassion of another. I think we've probably all experienced those moments of unhesitating compassion when we're faced with something very painful in others. But again, as with all of these qualities, this doesn't have to be episodic. It doesn't have to be accidental. It is why the cultivation of compassion is truly a pathway. It's a training. And I think for us, that training of inclining towards compassion, leaning towards compassion, it's a journey through some of our most well-embedded patterns. Think about how we often respond to dukkha. You know, we get busy, we want to fix it. I don't know what it was like in Denmark, but when the first wave of the pandemic hit here, you know, and people's lives kind of closed down. Wow, you should have seen my street. It was like a construction site. Everybody seemed to get busy. You know, if I can keep myself busy, I won't feel this. You know, I won't feel this. I won't be touched by this. Sometimes in the face of dukkha, we just want to avoid it. We just want to turn away. We fear our heart is not big enough to hold this. We fear being overwhelmed. Sometimes we dissociate, you know, we just kind of try to become more numb. And sometimes we become angry. And this is why compassion really is a training, because we're learning to move through these patterns, not to be so captured by them, not to be so governed by them, to know that they're there. But they don't have to govern. They don't have to govern. And to come back to what John raised just now and also this afternoon, these two aspects of compassion that are always interwoven. This aspect of empathy, being able to listen to the cries of the world, to be able to listen to our own hearts and bodies and minds, to the signals of distress, to have a heart that trembles in the face of pain or with the pain of another. This quality of empathy, it requires some stillness, doesn't it? It requires some stillness of being. It requires sensitivity. It requires us to be here. To really be here, to be able to listen well. I think if we miss out this very primary element of compassion, of empathy, I think when we're faced with distress, we often do just get busy in trying to fix it. And we know actually that not all pain can be fixed. Some things, of course, can be fixed, but not all pain can be fixed. And we almost redefine our understanding of what healing is. But it doesn't mean that something has to go away. I think this quality of empathy is almost like a pre-verbal responsiveness. It's not concerned with finding solutions. It's not concerned with blaming. It's concerned with being wholeheartedly present. Now, the second aspect of the word, the Pali that we translate into compassion, is actually Anukampa Karuna, as John said. And Karuna is actually what is born of that listening. What is needed? What does this moment, what does this situation actually need? What is helpful? It's much more the engage. It's not just feeling, you know, I'm so sorry, you know, for the pain you're feeling. It's actually, how can I help? It's actually, how can I help? You know, what can I offer? Sometimes all that can be offered is you know, my willingness to be a friend or a companion or, you know, a listener. But sometimes much more is needed to be offered. And Karuna has this very engaged sense. You know, sometimes when you see some of the imagery associated with compassion, and I'm sure there's plenty in the hall that you're in now, you know, often it's often the imagery is of a, you know, the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin, you know, with receptive arms, you know, and open eyes, this very gentle presence. And I think what is often overlooked is the imagery that is also a part of this array of the armed warrior. The armed warrior. The very deep commitment to bringing about the end to the suffering in this world that is actually optional, that is born of greed, hatred, and delusion. The commitment to bringing about the end of injustice, you know, of bias, of, you know, self-centeredness, the commitment to bringing about the end of this. So Karuna is really describing a way of being in this world, which I think is much bigger than our own self-interest. I think it's about how do we serve. It is seen that there's a lot of dukkha in this world that's simply unacceptable, because it is born of greed, hatred, and delusion, and it can end, not through more greed, hatred, and delusion, but through understanding and skillfulness and care and compassion. John, do you want to pick up there?
Yeah. One of the things that we can see that's going on with compassion, again, if we just pay attention to that little legend, mythology of the Buddha that I spoke about this afternoon, is that it requires an emptying of oneself, particularly of self-concern. Just to remind you of the image that was presented, it was said that the Buddha doesn't become Samyak Sambuddhasa, which actually means a fully enlightened, awakened being, until he sees suffering beings and makes the decision to teach. Yeah. His own self-concern actually said to him, I won't teach. He said, this is too vexatious, as the word is usually translated, you know, which means it's absolutely really difficult to do, and it's going to cause me a lot of trouble to do that. And if you look at the history of the Buddha and his teaching as it's portrayed in the Pali Canon, you'll see, yes, he has a lot of difficulties. So he wasn't initially wanting to do that. Yet it's out that movement of compassion, of the heart going out towards others, and the emptying of a degree of self-concern that allows that awakening to happen. Now, we're not talking about something, you know, as profound or as big as that, but in many ways we are, because we're talking about, for us to engage in any act of compassion means to put down the self in some way or another. So it ceases to be about me and becomes much more about you. And you notice this, you know, when this happens naturally, you don't even notice it. Suddenly that self-concern has dropped away. It's, you know, it's just fallen away in your concern for the other person. That is the response, the ability to respond. And what we're doing in this training is honing that, really beginning to develop that and cultivate this as a skill. Now, for a skill to become naturalized, it has to be practice. And it has to be, in a sense, responsive to the situations we find ourselves in. And you've heard Christina already say, you know, there are many different facets of compassion. We shouldn't think about it in idealistic terms of only having one face. There is that active, dynamic, warrior-like aspect that Christina spoke about. But there is also the time for that gentle, you know, non-intervention-based compassion. You know, the compassion that can, for example, listen. You know, to really listen requires an emptying of the self. To really hear another's pain and not to get involved in, you know, what has already been spoken about, the solving and the solution of the problem of dukkha, often which is trying to happen before the person has told their story, before they've even begun to really touch on what's really the problem. We've already tried to solve that problem because we want to get rid of it. So the openness that's required is an emptying out. Yeah. And one of the biggest obstacles I often feel to the development of compassion is we view it at almost too elevated a level. Yeah. Almost too elevated a level. Compassion is the daily is the daily emptying that we go through just when we think of another. Yeah. And that other might not even be present. Yeah. When we think of another's pain or the possibility of them being hurt in some way, is to actually open ourselves to the compassionate response. To walk on a path, I don't know, walking in the countryside or something, and to see something that somebody might trip over and to move that, you know, on the scale, this is not maha karuna, this is not the big compassionate act, but it is still compassion. And it is those little acts, the karuna, the doing, the actual engagement with thinking about others and doing something for them, even if they're not present, which is one of the defining features of the compassionate attitude. Yeah. That in a sense, again, I'm just reinforcing what I've said earlier, we have to put down self to think about others. And this doesn't mean that we become nothing, we become very little. This means simply that we put down that project of the self for that moment. Yeah, we're not nothing. We equally are deserving of compassion to ourselves, and being able to hold that and the pain that obviously is there, as the meditation I took you through this afternoon starts with that, holding our own pains and beginning to soften and see them and wish ourselves well. Yet, to actually truly engage in compassion for others means to put down that project of self with all its concerns, with all its constructions. This is a natural arising that happens spontaneously in certain situations. What we're trying to do is grow it. That's the bhavana aspect of it. We're trying to grow it so it doesn't become, as Christina says, sporadic. It becomes much more of a fixture within our lives and becomes, and this goes back to something I said yesterday, an expression of our humanity. Yeah, we all have these. Metta was the same. It's an expression of our humanity. In the way that I translate the Metta Sutta, for example, the little text on metta, is this aspect of metta is something we guard. You know, it's something we look after, something we treasure, and don't, in a sense, lose, or try not to lose, because in losing that capacity, we lose something of our humanity. The same is true of compassion. We need to develop it. If we don't develop it, it's like the muscle that atrophies. Yeah, it needs to be expressed. Yeah. Expressed in both our thought, our word, and our deeds as well. That's the karuna aspect of it, this idea of acting, making, doing something. Christina.
When I first began to practice, I sort of had this naive expectation that I was going to be told about how to sit on a meditation cushion and fast track my way to enlightenment. Instead, I ended up with a teacher who actually really discouraged all of that. And the first year of my practice was really spent on a whole range of reflections that all kind of centered around the theme of, why am I practicing? Why are you walking this path? What is the direction? To foster the kind of, I think, the appropriate motivation, and certainly in his eyes, the appropriate motivation for this pathway was compassion. I also came to learn that compassion is not one particular feeling. It is such a broad spectrum word, isn't it? When you think of unpack compassion, what is the landscape of compassion? There's patience, genuine patience. There's resilience, There's a certain groundedness, a resilience, a strength inwardly, so that we can bend in the face of suffering but not be broken. There's generosity, true generosity. There's forgiveness. There's forgiveness. And then there's the ability to bear with something. And then there's this very strange English word of forbearance. It's not about endurance, but the ability to bear with something, to bear with the difficult. All of this, I think, is the necessary landscape of this quality. And again, just like metta, we actually don't have to feel compassion to act compassionately. I don't have to feel a huge amount of compassion to step out of my busyness and help a frail person across the road. I don't have to feel compassion to put aside my plans and, you know, reach out to help someone who's not able to help themselves. It's interesting in Buddhist thinking that change is a kind of two-way street. It's both an inward-out process and an outward-in process. You know, sometimes we do have, you know, some very deep understandings and insights that truly change how we live, you know, and how we see and our views. You know, and sometimes we change our behaviors, and that actually helps us to change inwardly. And I think in like this Brahma Vihara, this quality of compassion, it is always a commitment to a very deep intention. That very deep intention of knowing what do we value most in this life? What are our greatest allies? What is it that helps to heal ourselves and the world that we live in? And this is a challenging journey, you know. Compassion comes very readily to us, you know, in the face of what I call innocent or blameless suffering or pain, you know, that an ill child, you know, there's so much pain in this world that people have never brought upon themselves. They've never brought upon themselves. There's also compassion becomes more complex, doesn't it? When we're faced with suffering that seems to have some sort of, self-infliction in it. People, you know, when they're self-harming or engage in patterns of confusion or addiction, compassion becomes much more complex when we're faced with those who cause suffering, who cause harm. And then I think this is actually the landscape of compassion. It's not just about what is easy. I think it's in those moments when it's the hardest that compassion is actually most needed. Because if we're unable to find those resources of compassion, we will become actually participants in harming through our own anger and through our own blame. And through our own judgments, we will be adding fuel to the fire. It doesn't mean condoning the difficult. You know, compassion is not idiotic. It doesn't mean condoning the difficult. It doesn't mean, you know, becoming passive. It doesn't mean that we don't actually have that commitment to uprooting greed, hatred, and delusion. But we uproot it within ourselves also. We uproot it within ourselves also. You know, I look at people sometimes, I look at people in my own family, you know, and my father died an angry man. You know, he managed to sustain his rage right until the end. And for a long time, I did blame him for his rage. And then I realized he was a child of the conditions in his life. This was a generational pattern, and he had no resources in order to bring about some change in that. He was a victim, actually, of his own rage. It made him miserable. It made his life miserable. And sometimes we need to see many things as being suffering. Rage, greed, self-centeredness, ignorance. All of this is actually dukkha. And when we really think about and consider, you know, what is compassion a response to? It's a response to dukkha. It's not an unthoughtful or an unintelligent response, but it is being able to see dukkha as dukkha. John.
Well, we are drawing fairly near to the end of this session. It's 5 minutes, and I really feel that we can't leave compassion without mentioning what is referred to as its near enemy. Within all of these Brahmaviharas, there are near and far enemies. The far enemies are usually pretty obvious. those are the far enemies are the obvious ones, but the near enemies masquerade very closely and look very similar to what we would call compassion or friendliness. And so in the case of metta, for example, the near enemy of metta is attachment. Yeah, this is the near enemy of metta. Yeah, we're not just being friendly, we're actually just being attached. That's all. I hope you can see how easy that is to confuse us in our own minds. I feel that we're expressing the genuine article, but actually what we're doing is getting more and more tied up with the attachment dimension. And the same is true, well, there's two often, it depends on which tradition, but there are two near enemies that are often placed as regards compassion. And I think the one is again, fairly obvious, because the near enemy of compassion is pity. Yeah. Pity, as the philosopher Nietzsche said, you know, is looking from a position of, you know, the person in the gutter. Yeah, it's a very again striking image. You know, so we're looking down upon those who are, you know, in a, you know, a distressed condition that perhaps we are not in. Whereas, you know, you've heard both of us say that there is this resonance that's going on that connects us with others, with not just our own pain, but with the pain of others. This is not a looking down. This is being on the same level as. So pity is something that can really easily look, you know, when we hear endless reports of tragedies and disasters and everything else, and we can take up that attitude of pity, which doesn't actually do anything. Yeah, this is the point about it. It perhaps is what I call a self-aggrandizing attitude, one which actually makes us feel good. Yeah, I'm feeling pity, I'm feeling something in this case, but it's not compassion that we're feeling. The other dimension, of course, which I see a lot when people talk about compassion, is it gets very sentimental. Yeah, and it isn't. It's incredibly practical. This is the whole dimension, and I hope that's been clear from both what Christina and myself have said. There's an incredibly practical dimension, and the practical dimension, I think, is there in what Christina was saying a little bit earlier, which is, how do we learn to be compassionate? And not just have an idea of it, how do we learn to be compassionate? Some of this will naturally arise out of feeling, yeah, as we've suggested. But some of it has to be practiced to learn it. And so there's a whole behavioral aspect, which I think is quite difficult for us in the West to often connect with. You know, so the Buddha is effectively saying, sometimes if you want to know what compassion is, to really see it, engage in it. Yeah. Don't wait around for a feeling. Often in the West, we have a kind of mythic notion of authenticity. I can't do something unless I feel it. Let me let you into a little secret, which is you could actually wait the whole of your life for the authentic feeling to arise here before doing anything. This is saying, if you want to know how it feels, engage in the activities. This is very true, given, you know, the nature of karuna, not the anukampa part, which is actually much more that sense of quivering, resonating, empathy. But with the karuna part, if you really want to know the depth of compassion, engage in the activities that go with it. Engage in the activities, if you can, of listening, of opening yourself. Engage in the activities of, you know, helping in whatever way that you possibly can. So it's a very practical, physical thing to do. And if we forget that, compassion just becomes a nice idea and nothing else. If you want anything to say anything more, Christina?
No, I thank you for that. I think that's a place where we'll end. Hopefully something to reflect on, something to reflect on.